Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
When we talked about former members of Congress to invite to be the inaugural Matsui lecturer, we looked for someone who reflected Bob Matsui's deep interest in bipartisanship and in substantive policy achievement, no matter how complicated or difficult the issue. And I think we could have found no one better than Jim Leach. Congressman Leach, to give you the basic biographical information, grew up in Iowa. He attended Princeton, the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies, and the London School of Economics. He entered the United States Foreign Service and was a delegate to the UN General Assembly and to the Geneva Disarmament Conference. But in 1973, he resigned his commission in the Foreign Service in protest over the so-called Saturday Night Massacre, when President Nixon fired the Attorney General, Elliot Richardson, and the Special Counsel, Archibald Cox. At that point, he returned to Iowa to join a family business, and then in 1976 was elected to Congress. He was reelected in all 14 times, serving 15 terms, 30 years in the House from 1977 to 2007. During his tenure in Congress, he chaired most notably the Banking and Financial Services Committee, certainly an issue of timely interest now. He also chaired the Subcommittee on Asian and Pacific Affairs and the Congressional Executive Commission on China. In addition to extremely important legislation on banking, he authored legislation on a wide variety of other issues, many with an international bent, including, for example, the creation of an international AIDS trust fund, debt relief for the world's poorest countries, and authorization of an IMF quota increase. After leaving Congress in 2007, he was interim director of the Institute of Politics at Harvard and has since returned to his alma mater, Princeton, where he is now the John L. Weinberg Visiting Professor of Public and International Affairs at the Woodrow Wilson School. He was a very moderate Republican in Congress, and perhaps reflecting some of the changes in the Republican Party, I suspect this is something he'll talk about. Last year, for the first time in his life, he endorsed a Democrat for President, Barack Obama, and he spoke at the Democratic National Convention, all of which I think makes him uniquely qualified and wonderfully qualified to address his topic today: the state of American politics, Obama, the new presidential dynamic, and the dilemma for the GOP. Congressman Leach.
Thank you, Ethan. I'm honored to be with you, and I'm instructed to indicate where my allegiances are, and I just want all of you to know I hope Maryland gets thumped tomorrow night. But the last time I was in this town, I was on the other side of the Berkeley issue. I was in the Berkeley Stadium. You know, it holds, I guess, 75,000 people. There were about 75 there. I was playing rugby for my undergraduate school, and the Berkeley Bears were a little tougher, I guess. In any regard, as a former colleague of both Bob and Doris Matsui and friend of each, I'm honored to inaugurate this lecture series. Bob stood for really the finest in public service his whole life, and I can't think of a more fitting new public policy initiative than one associated with his name and this great university. Perspective is probably the hardest thing to do to provide to events of the day, and hence, in what can only be described as very trying times, I thought I would begin with a brief reference to American political philosophy and then the American experience. And then turn to some of the very precise issues of this week. Our political philosophy is radically idealistic. Our constitutional experiment is premised on the precept that the state is subordinate to the individual, the government can only be rationalized if it's of, by, and for the people, and that public officials have the obligation to protect inalienable rights. And the assumption of our founders was that there is a narrow line between the state being a protector or oppressor. Hence, they established a constitutional framework in which power was circumscribed between three branches of government and then replicated in four different ways. That is, we have an executive, judicial, legislative divisions at the national level, at the state level, county levels, and city levels, and sometimes intermediate levels between. Power was thus, in the American sense, bifurcated with overlapping jurisdictions between and within levels of government, and always creating inherent tensions. As for the arc of our historical experience, it's been, with some exceptions, generally quite progressive. Generations hence, I think historians might suggest that we've had four great debates. The first was right at the founding of the Republic, whether you could form a society based on the rights of man. The second encompassed more than a century and included a civil war, the suffrage movement, the civil rights movement, and was all about definitions, whether the rights of man applied to people that weren't simply male and weren't simply pale. The third debate, which is symbolized in some ways by the New Deal of Franklin Roosevelt, the counterweight of the Reagan Revolution, is all about opportunity, how a society frames opportunity to fit the most people. And finally, the fourth debate, which was made particularly self-evident with the bombs dropped at Hiroshima and Nagasaki, is whether or not any rights are valid if there isn't a right to peace and environmental security. The first of these two debates have largely been resolved. The third will be ever with us, how you craft opportunity in the best way possible. And the fourth debate is one which is of increasing concern, not only from a security perspective, but as it pertains to domestic priorities and options. And so let me, with that as a background, turn to some of the challenges facing our governance structure today. And it's my view that the operative governance concern of the year is encapsulated in a single word, equity. Equity has two principal meanings. In one sense, it's a synonym for fairness, and another for money. This past year, Barack Obama won his party's presidential nomination because of the lack of equity in President Bush's pursuit of a foreign policy rooted in two notions. One, that international law neither applied to nor served the interests of the United States, and two, that a costly war could be financed by tax cuts and prosecuted against a state that neither attacked us nor stood as an imminent threat to our security. He then won the general election because of perceived unfairness in Republican tax and spending priorities, and because of a recession precipitated by incompetently regulated financial institutions, which were allowed to overleverage their equity capital and overinvest in leveraged financial instruments. Now, as president, Obama has inherited, but is unlikely to be held electorally accountable for, a neocon devised foreign policy. He has also inherited, but ironically could well find his administration jeopardized by, the precedent set and lack of equity implicit in his predecessor's regulatory legacy. And this is rather remarkable. I mean, when does one think of regulation as being critical in American politics? It's a very seldom referenced circumstance. But part of the trauma of today's economic contraction relates to accumulated effects of a generation of fiscal and trade deficits. Part relates to the cost in life, limb, and treasure of American citizens and the loss of goodwill for our country related to a war initiated by choice rather than necessity in the Middle East. And part relates to avoidable regulatory gaffes. These Brownie-esque gaffes, seemingly done by thoughtful people working within the citadels of our most sophisticated private and governmental institutions, are in retrospect inexplicable. There is simply no excuse for the overleveraging sanctioned by state and federal regulators of commercial and investment banks and mega insurance companies. There is no excuse for failure to understand the ramifications of the conflicts inherent in rating agencies and their reliance on income from the companies whose issuances they assess. There is no excuse for the loosening of mortgage standards, for not bracing for the consequences of an irrational roundup of home values, for the lack of attention to the onslaught of fraud among inner-city mortgage brokers. And from a preparedness perspective, there is no excuse for Congress's weak oversight and some of the legislated regulatory hurdles it provided the executive branch. Nevertheless, the executive branch must be firmly folded for its failure to follow through on what might seem to be rather obscure statutorily authorized laws and activities, from fraud and prevention abuse to the establishment of clearing facilities for swaps and derivatives products. The bailouts initiated by the last administration and continued to this day of AIG, Fannie Mae, and Freddie Mac, which thus far have cost taxpayers over $500 billion, represent uncompensated infusions of capital into Wall Street and mega international banks. It is still a mystery who got what, but is not who got Gort. Unwittingly, the United States taxpayer has provided welfare to Wall Street and launched a Marshall Plan for European and Asian banks, a bailout program that is not appreciated by the rest of the world because our government is being held accountable for precipitating the financial mess that we started in the first place. Over the last week, various congressional committees and the press have pressed the administration to list who recipients of AIG's largesse are. There's been a reluctance to respond, perhaps because of the anger the payments could generate, perhaps because no end of payments may be in sight. Few, if any, have noted, however, that just as AIG has guaranteed credit default swaps, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac have guaranteed many of the loans that they purchased and then repackaged for resale. Such guarantees are, in effect, insurance products, with the taxpayer also by governmental choice on the hooks as an unlegislated reinsurer. And I stress the notion by governmental choice because AIG, Fannie Mae, and Freddie Mac have not been forced to take bankruptcy protection, which would have stopped taxpayer hemorrhaging, although it would also have intensified international banking woes. And this brings me to the importance of two provisions of law that I authorized, one in 2000, one in 2006. The first provided the Fed, the Treasury, and the CFTC the right to establish clearing facilities for swaps and derivatives products. These facilities are key because they can help reduce, through netting, the trillions of dollars of swaps and derivatives products sloshing around world markets by magnitudes of 100-fold or more. And when coupled with the right of government and private parties to deal with swaps and derivatives products outside bankruptcy provisions and proceedings, a right statutorily provided in 2006, parties can, with governmental assistance and or through regulatory clearing facilities, make credible accommodations without falling back as completely on the taxpayer as they currently do. Thank you. Was I too close or too far? Oh, fair enough. Thank you. What all this means is that prior administration not only failed to regulate prudently, it failed to establish the mechanisms it was authorized to create to handle adversity. What it also means is that unless the taxpayers put front and center in concerns of public officials, this administration may become electorally jeopardized by the fairness issue as the last one was. It is, of course, imperative that the financial system be stabilized, but in what is shaping up to be a battle royale between shareholders and taxpayers, concern for the latter must come first. Fair enough. Thank you. Well, I have a low speaking voice, and sometimes I get close because I have to compensate for it, so I apologize for not practicing with this mechanism. Well, I'll try to raise your hand if I have a hard time being heard. In any regard, nationalization of banks need not take place, but there must be fair compensation for taxpayer infusions of funds to vulnerable institutions. And in the case of totally insolvent banks, there should be considered absolutely massive provision to the taxpayer of stock warrants that would provide a return in the event that things stabilize in a positive way, in the fairest way possible. Putting aside the politics of economics, let me turn to the politics of the moment in another way. There are two precepts in play. One relates to politics and one to policy. The Republican aversion in Congress today to going along with Democratic spending priorities is in part related to the GOP's failure to restrain spending or maintain fiscal balance under President Bush. A fiscally embarrassed party is bent on recapturing its old mantle of fiscal restraint. And that's why the minority leader of the House is reported to have said a day or two ago to his cohorts that Republicans should concentrate in this Congress on communicating rather than legislating. And that is making the majority party solely accountable for everything that happens, despite a clear preference of the president that Washington operate in as bipartisan a way as possible. My personal sense is that do-nothing or simply do tax cut alternatives are policy cop-outs. But such approaches might not be politically ineffective. Modern-day economists assume there are times when government, as the stewards of national resources, must act contrary to the family household, i.e., in difficult times, run deficits. On the other hand, many citizens assume that if they have to tighten their belts, the government should too. Thus, for the minority party, fiscal hard-headedness may be imprudent economics, but eventually pay off with political gains, especially if the economy doesn't turn around quickly or if it stabilizes at lower rates of growth than was experienced in the last half of the last century. The Republican assumption appears to be that it could lose the economist and laid-off labor vote, but the working middle class may become increasingly discomforted with the massive increase in public debt, which suddenly becomes its responsibility to repay. Despite the fact that the president keeps suggesting that restraint, including the possibility of entitlement reform, will have to follow the aggressive interventions underway in the economy, the question is whether the past is a very effective guide to the future. World War II indebtednesses, for instance, and Marshall Plan foreign assistance were accommodated largely by subsequent economic growth. But a slow growth future could cause politically unpopular choice making and disruptive reassessments of priorities. President Obama, in short, could pursue the most responsible economic policy possible and yet find his reward in kudos from economic historians rather than the Electoral College. And despite the fact that the best politics, particularly for the party in the majority, is the advancement of good policy, there are times when advocacy of bad policy, especially by a minority party that fails to get its way, can be surprisingly effective politics. Such are the vagaries of democracy. Which brings me to the political vagaries of our times. And to describe such, I developed in a course at Harvard and that I've subsequently advanced at my current teaching post, a series of what I call one-minute courses in American politics. And the first I call Political Science 101. And it is the assumption that our society, if you look at the last generation, is about a third Democratic, a third Republican, a third no party. But if you cut a third in half, if you're mathematical at all, you realize it's a sixth. So a sixth of the American people control the Republican Party, a sixth control the Democratic Party. But if you go to the greatest weakness in our democracy, and it isn't general elections, where sometimes it's noted that, quote, only half the people vote for president, the fact is, in primaries for legislative seats, generally at the very most 1 in 4 vote, and often it's 1 in 8, sometimes it's 1 in 16 participate. But if you go to the highest number, 1 in 4 participation, 1/4 times 1/6 is 1/24. So 1/24 of the American people control the Republican Party in a primary, 1/24 control the Democratic Party in a primary for a legislative seat. And don't be misled by the huge primary turnout for president this year. In legislative primaries, it's often very different. Well, 1/24 of America is pretty darn conservative, and 1/24 is pretty darn liberal. And so what you have is a circumstance where the great middle of America is often not represented in the primary process, and all primaries produce are the candidates and the party platforms, meaning they define the American political circumstance. Which brings me to Political Science 102, which is a little counterintuitive. Everybody in America that follows politics at all knows that when a candidate is running for president of the United States on the Democratic side, generally that candidate leans to the left. When a candidate runs for president on the Republican side, generally that candidate leans to the right. But in the general election, they both try to scoot to the center. In Congress, it doesn't work that way. And this is one of the most extraordinary phenomenons of our times. That is, about 380 of 435, or now 437 House seats, because we're giving the District of Columbia and is it Utah or Nevada? I forget which. You guys would know. Utah, an extra seat, are safe. In a safe seat particularly, the more conservative candidate is always likely to prevail in a primary, and the more liberal on the Democratic side in a primary. Once that candidate is elected in a safe seat, their only challenge is within their party. That means if one is elected as a strong conservative Republican, a strong liberal Democrat, if one wants to be an accommodationist or a compromiser or move at all to the center, one is jeopardized by someone coming from further to the right or further to the left in the next primary. And so candidates for Congress tend to be of the right and left, and they have no incentive to work in a way that works with the other party or work in such a way as to move to the center. And so it is no accident the Republican Party today has lost virtually all of its center. The Democratic Party has a few more, but not a lot more. And so in the Congress of the United States, where there's an assumption this is the people's body, and one has the assumption that people from all walks of life are represented, and there is some truth to that. But in terms of proportionality, the great underrepresented part of the American Congress, and this is Political Science 103, is the center. And if you take American history at almost any point, at any time, and Peter Hart is with us and he can indicate whether this is true or false, the country's rather centrist. But the center of America is not reflected in the Congress. And then you think about a political philosopher who very few people have ever heard of outside an academic center, but Americans kind of understand this, a German named Hegel, who talked about this thesis, antithesis, synthesis, and you have the notion that the Republicans have the thesis, the Democrats the antithesis, and somehow there's a compromise in the center. Well, over the last generation, increasingly in the Congress of the United States, the majority party is virtually the only place in which compromise is made. And sometimes it moves a little bit towards the center based upon compromises within it, but not based upon many compromises with the opposite party. And this becomes a very extraordinarily difficult situation. And then we have differing types of people running for office, with the great change being on the Republican side. Historically, the Republican side had a conservative dimension. One thinks if one's a little bit older, younger people have never heard of these people, but the great Nelson Rockefeller, Barry Goldwater divide. And basically, Barry Goldwater was a an economic conservative, a great individual rights advocate. Nelson Rockefeller was a great urban liberal Republican. But the fact of the matter is, the liberal wing of the Republican Party today is where Barry Goldwater was in 1964. Goldwater, for example, on the two base issues of modern-day social conservatism was pro-choice and pro-gay rights, based on basically the perception that liberal individual rights meant respect for everybody. Then the other aspect of this at a legislative perspective is that one visualizes always, you think of things as someone is philosophically here and philosophically there. And that, of course, one has interchanges and get along as people. But if you think in your own mind and you just visualize the typical social conservative today and the typical social liberal today and their backgrounds and who they are, it's impressive that type doesn't instantly get along. That there is not there's a kind of a sociological phenomenon there. And it gets accentuated with some courses, one I call Moral Philosophy 101, that there's an increasing number of issues that are defined as moral issues. And so, for example, if one is a social conservative and is pro or anti-abortion, dealing with someone that's pro-choice, and if that is perceived as a moral issue, it isn't that the other person you differ with or is wrong. The other person, by definition, is immoral. And likewise, on the Democratic side, there can be kind of a liberal smugness that one has to be for every increase in spending for every social cause, and to be opposed means lack of concern for whoever might be affected. And that becomes an almost moral issue, too. And so the other side is insensitive to fundamental problems. And so you have these real social divisions. And so we have in the Congress of the United States, for example, cloakrooms at the back. And cloakroom chatter on the Republican side is really unbelievably harsh about Democrats. And I wandered into the Democratic cloakroom a time or turn, and you hear the same phenomenon backwards. The feelings are less than perfect, which brings me to another course I call Marketing 101, and that is if you think about types that are running for political office today, they're increasingly salesman types. You got to sell an idea, and you got to sell yourself. Well, salesman types are very different than management types or executive types. And so both parties have salesmen and of a type that is not the same as management. And that's why sometimes you see candidates that seek higher office that I consider to be really fine legislators, but I don't think they necessarily have an executive bone in their body. And I've seen people in the executive that, to me, would have a very hard time being elected to a legislative seat. And there just are different circumstances. I made this dichotomy a few years back speaking at a speech in Beijing, and I noted that China today, despite all the differences we have with them philosophically, is increasingly run by an engineering class and America a salesman class, and I was talking to this blank-faced audience, and all of a sudden everyone came alive. That's right. I mean, it was really kind of interesting. And then afterwards, this young woman came up to me and said, "You know, Mr. Leach, we in China don't think much of salesmen," which I thought was a pretty funny phenomenon. But anyway, another course I have, which is my favorite course, I call Physics 101. Everybody knows that there is a chap named Sir Isaac Newton who had three laws of motion, and the third of which was for every action there's an equal and opposite reaction. That is, action equals reaction. Well, I announced to the world wasn't listening particularly, but in the mid-90s that I discovered the fourth Newtonian law. And this was discovered as a pun. I was watching the then Speaker of the House give a pretty firm diatribe against the Democratic Party on the House floor, and I was watching the reaction. And it dawned on me in social physics, unlike natural physics, reaction can sometimes be greater than action. And if I, for example, call someone here a bum, they're likely to call me something worse. And if we as a country suggest another society is evil, they're likely, rather than say, oh, we've got to change our ways, maybe to think a little differently back at us. And so words do matter. And in fact, the old schoolyard mantra that sticks and stones break bones, but names don't hurt, is not necessarily the case in the kindergarten of life, at least political life. Another moral philosophy course I have is that the only thing more corrupting than aspiring to power is fear of losing it. Members of Congress in particular consider their seat. It's not the public seat, it's their seat. And that then vindicates a lot of types of things that they might do in response to a challenger that might be a little imperfect. And one of the aspects of political life, and it seems strange, the public can have respect for two candidates or disregard for two candidates, but for sure the two candidates don't like each other. And it's just one of these commonplace things that occurs now and again. Another moral philosophy course, it relates to someone all of you have heard of and know about, Lord Acton, who once suggested that power corrupts, absolute power tends to corrupt absolutely. And I have a minor corollary to that, which is that military power tempts and excessive power tempts excessively. And one has to be very cautious when one has extraordinary power. And I think for that very reason, should be extremely careful about its utilization. My last moral philosophy course relates to seven deadly sins. Nobody knows the actual origin of the seven deadly sins, but two of them are that I like to contrast are greed and pride. And greed you might consider to be the sin of the business classes. I considered surprisingly practical. That is, one might be selling, let's say, microphones, but one can't sell it at too high a price, or a competitor will come in with a lower price. Or if you visualize a bookstore owner that reads two books, likes one, doesn't like the other, he inventories six of one, and the one he doesn't like, he inventories one. But if the public comes in and orders the one he doesn't like, he doesn't re-inventory the one he likes. He reorders the one that the public chooses. Surprisingly, in politics, once decisions are made, the hardest thing in this profession of enormous pride is to change gears. And it is amazing how people cannot and will not, and it's a very seldom phenomenon that they do, and then they have to be very clever about it. The cleverest phenomenon and the wisest that I've ever seen in public life related to a Californian named Ronald Reagan. Reagan, in his first term, was the most anti-arms control president in the history of the country. And I was part of a movement, because I had a background in arms control, favoring something called a nuclear freeze and favoring something called the SALT Accord, SALT meaning Strategic Arms Limitation Talks. Well, one day, as his second term was beginning, Ronald Reagan announced that was nonsense, as he had declared all his life. He said, but I favor something called START, which means Strategic Arms Reduction Talks. Well, START is more progressive than SALT by a quantum measure. And somehow, because he was such a good communicator and because he had people's confidence, he started to articulate a position that was absolutely totally opposite where he'd been, and it was considered logically consistent to build up in order to cut back. And all I can say is, I really respect him for that. That is the shift. But it's a hard thing to do. Most people cannot shift and get away with it in their own minds. And so the pride thing is a rather extraordinary phenomenon. I might say it has one dimension in American politics that is truly important, and that relates to the fact that in our society, democracy is no guarantee of good judgment, but it is sure the best system in the world in order to change bad judgment. And that is the great strength of our system. Well, let me continue with some other courses one relates to the whole notion of economics, which is the centerpiece of our time. And so one I call Economics 101 is that protectionism is to economics what interventionism is to politics. That is, they're flip sides of the same interventionist coin. Now, in the one, the executive plays a little greater role when you think of political intervention in other societies, although not an exclusive role. On the other, on protectionism, Congress can play a much larger role, although with executive concurrence, and we frankly may be moving into a protectionist era. The United States, for three quarters of a century, has more or less led the world in a progressive free trade direction, with certain exceptions. When times turn tough, all societies turn a bit protectionist, and there is a real possibility the United States could begin to lead the world in the opposite direction. And if that occurs, there could be some dangers. As economic historians will all suggest, protectionism did not cause the Great Depression, but it clearly deepened and lengthened it. I think it's something we're all going to have to watch. As a still Republican, I would say it's a greater danger of the Democratic Party than the Republican Party. But the Republican Party is getting more protectionist, too, and part of it is the nature of the people. Social conservative is closer to some of the protectionist instincts than a historical business conservative might be. Well, let me just end with three more quick courses. One relates to literature, and I call it Literature 101. When I was a student, the fashionable set of books in the 60s were a group of four books by an author named Lawrence Durrell called The Alexandria Quartet. And I don't want to go into these books with this simple, but make this simple notation. Durrell had written the four books about a single event that occurred, and a minor event in the interwar years in Alexandria, Egypt. And the first book was written in the first person and named after an individual. The second, the same set of events in the first person named after another individual. Third and fourth the same way. And one wonders, why do you read about the same event four different times? And it ends up that all four stories are totally different, all told in the first person by a different participant. And the moral was that any sense of reality, you have to look at something from more than one set of eyes. And when we look at world affairs today, what we do as a country may seem quite reasonable, might look different from a European or an Asian or a Middle Eastern perspective or an African's perspective. And so one of the things that I think all societies have to be very cognizant of is the need to look at things in many different ways. And the same applies to one's community. The same applies in courtroom settings. It's amazing. We give great veracity to eyewitness accounts, and some of the studies are indicating that eyewitnesses are imperfect. And part is it relates to the fact that we just look at things differently as human beings. The last course I call Reality 101. Over the past several years, there have been two Harvard theorists, Samuel Huntington and Joe Nye, who've written about the dangers of a class of civilization and the necessity of looking at a role for what's called soft power in international relations, the role of diplomacy and culture, et cetera. I think these are very interesting and very important frameworks of thought, and I would only add to them something that strikes me as very relevant about the last administration, and that is that there is a distinction between realism and what I call pseudo-realism. It is amazing how people uttered in grim-faced ways, you have to look at the world realistically. Well, what was the realism that was uttered? And one was, we're a superpower, and we should operate as a superpower, and others can't do what we can do, and so we don't have to be constrained by the views of others. One was that alliances don't matter a lot. International law is unimportant. But if you ask anyone, whether you be at Berkeley, whether you be at the University of Iowa or the University of South Carolina, and you look left and right and you ask someone next to you, would you as an American citizen rather work in alliances or without alliances? Would you as an American citizen rather broaden the rule of law or narrow it? Instinctively, Americans want to work with allies. Instinctively, Americans are law-abiding. And yet somehow we let a class of neocons, and who I call pseudo-realists, dominate our policy. And to me, that's extraordinary. One of the myths of our times is that realism is principally about might. Actually, it's about the human condition. Nations which are ill-led and ill-fed are breeding grounds for radicalism, and where there's no hope, there's very little to lose. And so we all, when we think from abstractness, I remember when I first read Thomas Hobbes, I thought this was very, very interesting, total abstract lack of reality, the notion that life could be nasty, brutish, and short. In a jungle of human behavior. And yet, if you look at the Middle East today, Hobbes looks pretty relevant in some parts of the world. I think when we think of our policies, we are best off if we try to combine some sort of idealism with Yankee practicality. Well, because this is March Madness week, let me end with the last course, which is I call Sports 101. There are a lot of very profound analogies between politics and sports. 75 years ago, there was a prominent journalist named Grantland Rice who once said that, you know, how you play the game is more important whether you win or lose. And I think the same is true in politics. The temper and the integrity with which the political fight is waged is far more important than the outcome of any issue in most circumstances. And the problem in modern politics is that there are very few rules and there are no referees. And so the public has to be on constant guard. The most profound political observation of the last century and maybe ever was given by a scientist, Einstein, when he suggested that splitting the atom had changed everything except our way of thinking. And so the implication being that human nature is a constant, whereas some of the challenges are somewhat unprecedented. And one of the things 9/11 taught us is that the danger is not exclusively the big bomb. I mean, that very small acts of anarchistic and hateful behavior can be very implosive in their nature. When you think about violence, when you think about division, they're often rooted in hate. And so sometimes we have to think about the hearts and minds of people. In our Western civilization, probably the most prophetic poem was that of William Butler Yeats, The Second Coming, when he noted that the center couldn't hold when the best lack all conviction and the worst are full of passionate intensity. Well, apocalypse isn't a field of study, but it would seem that the chaos of our times is such that there is a crisis of perspective that people ought to look at. In this last election, for example, in my state of Iowa, the challenging Senate candidate suggested the incumbent senator was a Tokyo Rose. In the state to the north of Iowa, in Minnesota, a congressperson suggested that the members of the Congress ought to go through a test to see if they were American enough. We had a senator, a United States senator, who described Barack Obama's policies as communist. These are really tough assessments and socially both inaccurate and of a negativity of a type that I think is very dangerous. And One of the things, and I want to return to the sports circumstance for a moment, when one plays a game, football, wrestling, which is, of course, the greatest of all sports, or for that matter, a women's crew team, one really strives to win, but one generally, the more one plays, the more one respects the opposition. And kind of inherently, the public thinks, why shouldn't that be the case in politics? But it hasn't worked out that way. So in conclusion, just let me emphasize the reason I kind of have put together these one-minute courses is that to emphasize that so many things are related to everything else, and that when you think of the maturation of an individual, it's how you tie things together. And as I look at our country and in the founders, who were really political philosophers, and they also looked at human behavior as a central reason for doing certain things, it strikes me that in many ways our country was far more mature at its infancy than it is today. Thank you very much.
In hindsight, was the repeal of Glass-Steagall Act a mistake?
No, definitely not. It's a widely misunderstood circumstance, and so let me take a minute. Are you the gentleman that wrote it? Okay. What a 1930s law called Glass-Steagall had created were three cocoons of economic activity, commercial banks, investment banks, and insurance. Over a period of time, technology had changed radically, and the market had changed radically. And so when Glass-Steagall was first passed, about 70% of the saved dollar was in commercial banks. By the 90s, about 25% of the saved dollar was in commercial banks. And that what you had was no competition between various kinds of financial institutions, or less competition between various kinds of financial institutions. And so what a change in Glass-Steagall, and by the way, not a repeal, very important elements of Glass-Steagall were maintained, was about increasing competition, and it was about re-regulation rather than deregulation. That is, all the fundamental regulation stayed in place, plus new regulation was added. And let me be very descriptive of this. If a commercial bank were to take on an insurance activity, that insurance activity would be regulated by the insurance regulator, the bank by banking regulators. If a securities company were to take on a banking function, the banking part would be regulated by the banking regulators and the securities by the securities. In addition, as part of the law, a primary regulator was designated so that an increasing number of products were combinations of insurance, security, and banking. And that the primary regulator would ensure that no kind of product fell through the cracks. In addition, I added to this particular bill the largest privacy protections in the history of the United States Congress, which were all new levels of regulation. Now, having noted that, there are some problems of what Congress has done in the 90s. Egregious law that was passed was one in 1992 relating to the regulation of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, in which Congress passed a captive regulator model. And among other things, under statute, these institutions were disallowed from paying state income taxes. They were allowed to count what's called loan loss reserves as capital. They were allowed to leverage to a far greater extent than any other financial institutions in America. And this was one of the least wise laws that I've ever known in the regulatory front. There are also aspects of a law passed in 2000 called the Commodity Futures Modernization Act that were imperfect. And one related to taking a given type of derivative product and saying it couldn't be directly regulated, but this only applied to institutions that were as institutions regulated by the SEC or the banking regulators. I think Congress should not have allowed that particular instrument to be deregulated, But the assumption was the regulators would understand what the business was doing. As it worked out, the regulators didn't bother. But those are the two most problemsome laws. But Glass-Steagall also has proved to be highly helpful, or Glass-Steagall repeal in this circumstance. For instance, three securities companies have basically gone under. And there's been they've been taken under the umbrella of banks, two American banks and one British bank, although the British bank just took over some of the assets of Lehman Brothers. But under Glass-Steagall, that wouldn't have allowed to be happen. You'd have had to have a public bailout, or these institutions would come under perhaps unfriendly foreign control. And so it's been helpful there. It's also, this particular act had some other provisions that are way too subtle for the American public, but allowed smaller community banks to have greater capacities to liquefy loan portfolios of small business and agricultural loans, so that you don't see near the number of community banks in difficulty as you see large banks. And actually, if you look at regulation over the last decade, good regulation in banking has been in inverse proportion to size of institution. And the large banks have gotten away with murder. And that's why there's been a murderous result.
I'd just like to go back to your comments about the polarization in the Congress and in the election process and so on. Just want to ask you, are you aware of any kind of proposals or initiatives or ideas as to how to start trying to change that to where we're going to, where the center can get some kind of recognition or representation?
Yeah. Well, that's a very interesting question. Human nature is a difficult thing to deal with. I mean, we used to have in the Congress some assemblies where you'd take a retreat for a weekend, both parties go somewhere a couple hours from Washington, and you get to know each other a little bit. Some of that can be helpful. One of the things that breaks things down is that every year I was in Congress, I felt the time constraints increased. And so it was amazing how little time you had. And when you read the histories of the old days in Congress, when people didn't go home, but more than that, legislation wasn't very difficult, and very few people played a role. And so afternoons, lots of drinking that was done in little groups and whatever. And in fact, alcoholism was a serious problem in Congress. I will tell you, of all Congress's problems, it's not a problem today. There is everywhere, but there's not a lot of alcoholism. And part of it is you're so busy. And that doesn't mean that a legislative job is a heavy lifting job, but it is truly a time-constrained job, because you have schedules and then you have interruptions of schedules. And the interruptions are whether they be bills and votes, whether they be committee votes, whether they be committees that have overlapping time frame jurisdictions, or constituents that come in, many of which you should want to see. And so it's a job that you don't control your time. Probably as much as any job I know of in that regard. And when you get tied up that way, one of the problems is, how do you interrelate with your colleagues? And if you visualize the Capitol building, and then on each side there are three sets of office buildings, on the Senate side and on the House side, it is amazing how you get tied up in your own little set of office buildings. Now you break out of it as you go to committee meetings. Obviously, the greatest socialization in Congress are the elevators. I mean, it's amazing, because you're always rushing over to vote, and you have small elevators, and you try to get there as late as you can so you can do as much whatever you're doing before as possible. And so everyone comes at much, and so you get 20 people crammed into a 10-person elevator, and so you get a feel for each other. Interesting circumstance. Now, I think, at least it's my sense, that the two parties have more and more caucuses. And so the parties get to know each other better. I frankly, about 15 or 20 years before I left, I stopped going to many caucuses. I mean, I got tired of some of the tirades and felt I had other things to do. But the between the parties, maybe you could say there should be an in-between caucus. Or the only couple times that people come together in a collective sense were some what I call Dodge times. And that is, if you take the last war in Iraq, DOD and the secretary might come up and speak before in at one of the chambers. It might be the Armed Services Chamber, but not before the committee, or sometimes in a Capitol building. And they would announce that there would be nobody could take any notes, nobody could take any recordings. And because this was, quote, off the record. Well, I never went to a single one of these meetings in which a single thing was said that was classified. It was all to defend the people uttering. I mean, I guarantee you, if the quotes of these people were on the public record today, people would be shouting in laughter at them. I mean, quotes like, well, the war will pay for itself, or, I mean, all these things that people were presuming, but many other types of things. And so it was a really clever executive branch thing, and it always made me think that, by God, if I was ever in the executive branch and there was an embarrassing situation, I would want to have a closed-door meeting with the members. You know, definitely you don't want to go on public record. And so that there those types of things occur a little bit that are bipartisan. Mainly you get to know the other side a little bit by watching. For example, I would watch Tip O'Neill, who was Speaker, and he never did I have a personal conversation with Tip O'Neill. But he did a great favor for me that I'll never forget. I mean, my second term, I wanted to get on the International Relations Committee, and my party said I could, but I'd have to give up the committee that I was somewhat senior on, even though I was barely there. And so I couldn't do that. And the day before the committee assignments came out, Tip O'Neill called the Republican leader, a guy named John Rhodes, and said that he would give another seat for international relations, but only if they gave it to me. And I never knew why he did that. I mean, never in a million years. But I always thought Tip was the fairest partisan I ever knew. That, I mean, this guy didn't have a nonpartisan bone in his body, but he had a real instinct for fairness. And I always thought he was a giant.
Actually, on that note, okay. Let me get the last question.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.